ball. Step right up. Step right up, ladies and gentlemen. Portal Gaming Podcast, episode number 145. Coming at you right now. You weren't on any mercy mission. That's the title for this episode. Howdy, everybody. Portal Gaming Podcast. Podcast brought to you by a store called The Portal, which is located in Manchester, Connecticut. For more information, you can log on to Facebook and go to our page there, The Portal. And you can check us out on Twitter at PortalGaming60. Hello, everybody. I am your host, The Brant, for this episode. I am driving in my car. And Portal Gaming Podcast is a proud member of the Dice Tower Network. You can check out all sorts of podcasts at www.dicetowernetwork.com to suit your board game podcast needs. We're glad to be one of those podcasts that you come to and listen to, which we mainly focus on reviews and some, short topics and perhaps some things about the retail end of the board game hobby is kind of what we focus on. As I said, I'm driving home in my car right now, sneaking in an episode here, probably about a 30-minute episode. I'm going to do my best. It is dark. It is night, and I'm on like an hour-plus drive home here, so figured I would talk to y'all for a little bit, if that's okay. I'm glad to be able to have this awesome Zoom microphone that picks me up so well in my car. I know there's a little extraneous noise as well, but it's still pretty darn good. So really blessed to have been able to purchase this mic and be able to record on things like this. And it was a whopping 71 degrees today here in Connecticut, which is in New England, the upper eastern states in the United States. And so 71 degrees. Just to give you an idea, our average morning temperature in January is around this time of year is about 15 to 20 degrees Fahrenheit. And typically in the day, the average, I believe, is between 30 and 35 degrees. And it was 71 degrees today. Took a picture and posted on Twitter last night because yesterday was similar. It was in the 60s. And myself and the kids were outside playing after dark, barefoot, playing out in the yard on the swing set. And it was still dusky. In fact, we played right clear till dark, ran around outside. It was beautiful. It was awesome. I really enjoy winter weather. I love snow. I don't mind the cold. Brutal cold when you start getting down below 20, 10, 0 degrees. That's a little much. So that's not so exciting. The negatives in Celsius, if you will. But I don't mind it because I do like the winter weather. However, having an unseasonably warm day in the 60s and 70 degrees is quite fun. It's interesting to be cooped up all the time. It's kind of nice to open your windows, just get outside, drive with the windows down. It certainly was nice. Kind of similar to having a cool day where it rains in the summer. And you could just kind of get outside and escape that humidity and cool off and run in puddles and whatnot. You know, I like both ends of that. So the kind of change is always nice. But yeah, it was quite cold. Nope, quite warm. And next weekend will be quite cold, and we're probably getting a snowstorm. I saw somebody say, hey, the weather in New England is like lottery numbers. 67, 12, 19, 35, 46, you know, zero. Something like that. I thought that was pretty apropos for what happens around here sometimes. I know weather could be crazy kind of wherever you live, but it seems like New England really gets the up and down a lot more than other places. So I enjoy that. I like that element a whole bunch. I hope your new year is going well. Happy New Year to you. We are definitely halfway through January by the time you hear this. But I hope 2020 goes great for you and what you're looking forward to, both in board gaming, your personal life, business, otherwise, all those things. Hopefully you have joy and prosperity and even that opportunity to humble yourself, reach out to others. I think it's super important. It's kind of what I'm going to focus on at the end of this, calling this episode Mercy Mission, and seeing what our hobby can do and what how it all works in terms of all that. Just want to give that a little look. Like I said, probably a 30-minute episode. So I'm going to review some games here as I do, and then we will move on to that topic and wrap things up from there. It sounds funny to say wrap things up when I just got started. So All right, here we go. A game I've only gotten to play solo so far is Fantastic Factories from Meta Factory. And this is a game I heard a lot about. I saw it at PAX Unplugged. Finally managed to get a copy and give it a play. Like I said, I've had just solo plays so far. So essentially, it's a card drafting, card tableau game. There's dice rolling, but the dice rolling is almost like how you collect resources that you want to spend, and it's very mitigatable. So you play a series of rounds. You're trying to get 12 cards in your display, no, 10 cards in your display, or 12 products, crates, that you're producing in terms of that. So what do you do in a round? First, you draft a card. There's kind of two sets of cards. There's kind of your building cards or your machine cards, and then your workers or extra people you can hire. So you draft one of those cards that will either put a card in your hand or give you a special ability for that round. Then you roll four dice, more if you have a bonus. And then between using your dice and playing your cards, you try to build up a little engine. So it's definitely an engine-building game. In order to build a factory card, you have to discard resources. So there's minerals and there's or ore, I guess, and energy. So you discard those tokens as well as you get rid of a card that has the same type of symbol. So there's like a wrench and a gear and a hard hat, etc., things like that. Discard a card to get that resource, discard your other resources, and then you can play that card. And now that card will have all sorts of special abilities. Roll additional dice, spend resources to generate other resources, yada, yada, yada. And the main one would be spend resources, sometimes including cards, discarding cards, in order to produce crates or products or whatever they are, which is like the main source of scoring points at the end of the game. Your dice you can use on a little player board where you can use them based on their number to draw new cards. You cannot draft, gain ore or gain energy. And there's kind of a little play that you can do there. Like if you play pairs in a region, you get a bonus one. One, twos, and threes can get that much energy. Four, fives, and sixes just get you one of the ore. Bunch of little different things, and you can kind of mitigate yourself around and manipulate your dice with some of your factory things there. And you keep going until you get to that threshold and then see what you score for points. The solo play has a little, you know, way you play against it. But if you're playing other players, you're just trying to get the most points. At the end of the game, which will be triggered by one of those events, and then you play one more round after that. Kind of standard Euro, I suppose. And at the end of that round, you'll add up your points, which is basically those crates that you made, plus there's points on all of your factory cards. Whoever has the most points wins, and that's the game. Pretty simple engine building, kind of clever in that front. I definitely enjoy it. I could see what people are kind of clamoring about with the game, but in the grand scheme of engine building cards, I'm not sure. The dice don't add too much to the game. The drafting's kind of interesting. It's certainly simpler and certainly shorter than Wingspan. And so I can see that being a draw for people that are looking for more of that entry level. But compared to something like Race for the Galaxy, where the decisions are so rich and giving up cards, it doesn't have as much of that in this. And in terms of engine build, you know, you're going to get a lot more from a Fleet the Dice game or a Terraforming Mars or a Maracaibo. Now, granted, those later games are going to run 2+ hours. So this is, you know, 30 minutes. So it's very fast. So it's probably a lot more compared to Race for the Galaxy. I certainly would prefer Race to the Galaxy or Wingspan over this game, but it's not like it's not fun. So I would certainly recommend it if this is the one you're going for, if birds aren't interesting to you or space isn't interesting to you. Race for the Galaxy is hard to actually recommend because it's so difficult to break through in terms of learning how to play. This one is not difficult to learn how to play. So this one is better for that end of it. But all in all, I don't know that it's really a keeper for me. It's something, you know, that hopefully will end up at the store, and I can definitely see people playing it. It's a nice light one to bring to a pub or a game day or to teach people when you know, hey, we've got 30 minutes till they finish their game. Let's play this. But not a standout game to me. That's Fantastic Factories from Meta Factory. Hold on, let me see what's up next. I've got a list here and I'm driving. So the next game I have on my list is Nine Tiles Panic. So Nine Tiles Panic is from... Oh, no, I can't remember the company. Oh, I apologize. They made Deep Sea Adventure and Fake Artist Goes to New... Oink Games. Got it. So this game from Oink Games. So Nine Tiles Panic is essentially a real-time game. You're playing a series of rounds to get to a point threshold based on the number of players. So what happens is you flip three cards and they're going to give you the conditions. It's a very weird theme. I guess the theme is Earth where aliens are invading? There's not much theme. It's you got nine tiles, hence the title, and every player gets their nine tiles. You have to build a 3x3 grid, and you're just given conditions like have the most spies or have the most aliens next to each other, have the most boys on roads or girls on roads or have the least number of roads. Kind of akin to Sprawlopolis, that co-op game where you're trying to build all these things and your tiles are double-sided. So you flip up three cards with these conditions and then you say go and everybody builds their 3x3. When you're set, you grab a tile from the center, like based on the number of players, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, whatever number of players there are, there's that many tiles. And then you flip a timer and everybody, I think maybe the last player, the first player, forgot. Flip a timer and people have that much time left. And then you kind of go through and score those categories. And the categories just kind of score. First place will get X, where X is the number of players, and then X minus 1, X minus 2, all the way down in terms of number of points that you can score. If you end up with nothing in that category, though, you don't score. And then you just kind of go through each of those. And all ties are broken by who finished first, which is a pretty big deal because there's not a lot. So if it's like whoever has most boys and three people have boys, if you're done first, you're breaking that tie and getting the 4 points. And the next player's three and then two. So definitely it's a big tiebreaker in that game. And you just keep playing rounds until the point threshold is met for whatever it is. I think like in a three-player game, it might be 15 points or something like that, 16 points. And that's the game. It's pretty fun. It doesn't really escape being real-time. The real-time is important. That tiebreaker is huge. It's fun to kind of get your tiles, but eventually you kind of learn what they are. You just kind of flip them all over fast and then rotate them through and go. And the thing to remember is if you can break the tie, even if you end up with two roads instead of one road when it wants minimum roads, you might still break the tie with somebody and get a decent number of points. So, you know, speed becomes an important element of the game, and people are going to immediately be out or in based on speed. So it's a clever little game. It's something I play again, but again, not, you know, itching to get it back. But my goodness, rounds are 2 minutes, and you play three rounds, so it's a 5-10 minute game. So, I mean, it's a classic filler for that point. Like, oh, let's play this. But I did play, like, Fantasy Realms recently, six-player, and that's a great filler that's, like, 15, 20 minutes. You score a lot of points, so I could see pulling that out instead of something like this. Sorry, it's weird to do a comparison in a review, but just thinking of examples, that's kind of how I go. But, again, certainly fun, certainly worth it, not expensive, so neat little game, Nine Tiles Panic. Next up, I just wanted to mention Castell. So I got a chance to go back and play Castell, which was my 2018 game of the year, although I guess Underwater Cities kind of usurped it. I kind of took that as a 2019 game. Whichever, it's right up there, 1-2 in 2018. And I guess I'll plug my recent episode of... I was recently on Sporadically Bored with Mike and Dan, Mike Delisio and Dan Hughes, and they were asking me for my underrated game, and I gave them Castell as my underrated game. I just think, you know, Renegade puts out so many games now, and it's hard for them to focus, and this is just a phenomenal game. Went back and played it again just to kind of reassure, like, did I really think this was good, or did I just want to push it? It's really good. It's totally underrated. The game's phenomenal. Now, it's a little bit multiplayer solitaire. There's definitely a good amount of interaction in the game, especially if you play it four. If you play it two, there's a little bit less. And it does have a little bit of limiting based on what can come out. There's a little bit of randomness with all the different things. You're building these Castell towers, which is people, you know, human towers, and traveling around. And I'm guessing if you listen to the podcast, you've heard about the game before. But I just wanted to go back and mention it in here because I had played it recently and talked about it there. And it's still phenomenal. So I still suggest that people go out and, boy, I would just buy the game. If you know you like Euros, I would definitely buy the game. If you sometimes like Euros, it could be AP-inducing. The problem with this game on the AP end is that you have to build all these human towers, and there's all these rules, and then you train to, like, add more rules or break the rules, whichever way you want to look at that. And it essentially gives you so many combinations that I don't think you can guarantee that you have the best combination. But you can certainly do a really good one, whereas you might have been able to get 5 points, you could get 4, and you're fine. And you could still win the game, and there's lots of different things to do. You could spread out across the southern Spanish, that Catalina region or whatever, or you could not. Yeah, there's just so many options of things to do. I could see that being a little tough with an AP person, but overall, I don't think it's too bad. I've played with people that are AP, and they just kind of, you just, boy, because it's multiplayer solitaire-ish, you sit there and you just keep constructing towers and trying to break the rule, and you're like, I'm satisfied with this. Wait, and then you start readjusting it again, and then people are like, oh, it's your turn. You're like, oh, okay, I'll go with that one. Oh, let me go back to this one, and then you take your turn. It's not too bad. I mean, people's turns are like a minute. There's 3 actions with an option for a 4th, and you can do them in any order, but they're really simple. Move 1 space, pick up 2 more Castellers, and then, like, train. It's just ultra simple in terms of all those, and the mechanics easily get out of the way. I mean, you want to talk about a game where the rules get out of the way and you play the game. That's this game. That's what makes Castell so good. You're playing the game, not the rules. The rules would make you think it's a light game, and the playing of the game makes you understand it's medium, and for some people it would certainly be medium heavy in terms of all that and all that thing. So anyway, great game, Castell from Renegade Games. So I'm going to plug it here again in my episode that I was on there, which I thought was pretty fun. So you can check that out. Okay, next up on the list of games to be reviewed is Cooper Island. Cooper Island is a big game from Frosted Games and Capstone Games. Cooper Island is a game of sailing and building up your island. It is a heavy Euro game where you play over a series of rounds to try to score points. And points are not abstract. They are the distance that your boats travel. And so in each round, there's kind of an income phase. And if I remember correctly, it is 5 rounds. There's an income phase where, yeah, you collect some income, but really what you're doing is you're adding terrain tiles to your map. And so you add these terrain tiles, and then you put cubes on those tiles. And so if I make a village, I put a purple cube on it, and now that counts as 1 cloth or 1 silk item. And after I remove that cube, I can actually stack another one on there. Now I'd have 2. My height would be 2, and I'd put a cube on there, and now that counts as 2 silk. Kind of have to spend it all at once, but that's the main idea. And then the rest of the game, after you do that income phase, placing various tiles, moving ships, and the distance from your board, you travel around to other people's boards, the distance that you travel, which is really easy because every time you travel 5 spaces, you collect a little logbook and get a bonus. So at the end, you just count your logbooks, they're all 5 points, and then any extra spaces you made with a few other things that you can get points from. So it's really easy. It is a pretty low scoring game. You're talking in the 20s and 30s points wise. The rest of the game is then just worker placement. So you've got discs and you've got square workers. You start with discs and you can upgrade to squares, and you place them out on 8 spaces. Now you might say, oh no, 8 spaces, what if you have 4 players? Well, places will get blocked, and then you'll have to pay coins to that player to go on top of their space. And then you can eventually upgrade to get the square disc. When you go in the square spaces, you get like a bonus, like you pay less for this space or something like that. What's interesting, and one of my negatives in the game, is if somebody goes on a square space ahead of you and then you go on top of them, you don't get the bonus. You have to pay them and you don't get the bonus. And that worked out very negatively for me in one of my plays. It is a very tight resource game. You need to know where every dollar, where every resource, what every play is going to do to play this game well. There are then like cards in the center of the table that tell you how you can score 3, 5, and 8 bonus points by putting your workers there, and you really want to make that a focus, I imagine people that are very good at this game are going to score 2 of those cards, probably 1 for 5 and 1 for 8. I'm sure there'll be somebody at some point will score 2 for 8 points, and that's 13 bonus points on top of your, say, 20, and they're going to push into the 40 points. Didn't see it in my plays, but it might be there. There's solo play for this. I have not tried it. The rules are online, not in the rule book. It's definitely fun. I would definitely play it again, but the game does not allow you to pivot 1 inch. So if somebody gets in your way and you're 1 resource short, you're just sunk. You're just out of luck. That's happened to me in the final round. I was trying to get 5 boats out, or like these boat, like these, what would they be, boats that come into my port, you know, coming in, and I ended up just 1 resource short of a space that somebody took. They blocked the bonus, now I couldn't use the bonus, and I could only get 4 boats out, not 5, and that cost me 3 points, and then I had to spend to do other things to even do that. It's just really, really tight. Now, some people are going to love that. They're looking for that. They want, like, as heavy and interactive and tight as possible, and so it's going to be a great game. For me, the more I'm playing games, the more I'm discovering I don't necessarily want that. Now, I like interaction. I like things to happen. I don't necessarily want everything to be multiplayer solitaire. I'm not anti-conflict. I really like conflict in two-player games. In other games, it's just tricky. It's got to be well done. But I found this one just to be too tight, that it was just not really stressful. I don't know if I stress during games, but just like, okay, that plan is shot, so what's my backup? There's no real plan B. I can't suddenly ult because I've put my worker on this card and I've committed to it, but I cannot possibly get the resources even with a round left. So what do I do in that round to just kind of score subpar points and end up in third place and instead of having 15, have 18 points? Like, it just... that's not super interesting to me. I'm not the best at going into a round or two knowing I've lost this game and I've just got to wait for other players. Now, I know there's an inch of impatience there. I guess this is kind of the truth, right? Like, it's like, oh, I'm not going to win this, so just here's some points. I don't really try to min-max third place anymore. In terms of all that. Now, in the reverse, it can be tricky. If I'm winning, I will still min-max in the chance that I think somebody's going to come back and beat me. And I know that could be a little bit frustrating, so I'll admit a little bit of hypocrisy or difference there, which is not really my goal. But anyway, point being, when a game gets really tight like that, it can be tough. And when you're not able to pivot, I find that frustrating. So I like the ability to pivot, which the ultimate example of that to me is Through the Ages. That game is just begging you to pivot. However, it also allows you to not pivot, meaning choose a new strategy. You could hammer that strategy, and it may be the winning strategy. I'm doing that again. I'm comparing to another game. Anyway, I like to pivot. Through the Ages does that well. Cooper Island didn't do that as well. But I definitely could see what people would like about this game. I saw this on a lot of top 10 lists, and I wouldn't deny anybody that and try to argue that it's a bad game. I guess it's not for me, is really what I would say, and I think that's a completely plausible review, because reviews shouldn't be the game is inherently good or the game is inherently bad, but I enjoyed this and I didn't enjoy that, and I enjoyed the game overall or I didn't enjoy the game overall, or I would play it again or I wouldn't. I would actually play Cooper Island again. I think it's actually kind of fun to teach. But you compare it to some of the other Euros this year, Paladins and Maracaibo, and it's just not quite as good as those. Awesome. I think I've got 2 more here. Let me see. Okay, another game I played was Blitzkrieg. So Blitzkrieg is a 2-player World War II and 20 minutes game from PSC Games and designer Paolo Mori. And so essentially one side takes the Axis, one side takes the Allies, and you draw some chips, put them behind a screen, and you've got land, you've got air, and you've got sea. Land and sea are specific, so on your turn you take a chip from behind your screen, you place it on a spot, and you move a track, and the tracks are the different theaters of war. Southeast Asia, and Africa, and Europe, and all the different, you know, places in World War II. and you're moving this little cube along a track, and the chip will tell you how far to move, and there's bonuses on spaces, and you can collect new tiles and various other things, and then the air tiles can go either in the land or the sea spaces. When you finish out a track, you get more bonus points, and you're trying to move those tracks in your favor to score bonus points as you kind of finish off. There's almost like rows, and as you finish a row, it'll score that one, and that person will get points, and then it's kind of a race to 25 points. It's pretty interesting. It's very light. It is completely 20 minutes, so there's no lie on that end of it. It was a little too light for my taste. I don't mind that it's themed World War II. I think that kind of makes sense. It really could be themed anything in terms of that, so that's not really a draw in terms of calling it a war game or whatever. It was pretty fun. There's definitely more two-player games that I would prefer to play, but this one was uber light. I actually played it over lunch at lunchtime. A friend of mine works in the same building that my school is in. He came down, we played, and it was super easy to get to lunch. I mean, the rules teach us like 2 minutes, and then we played it probably in 15 minutes, and then we were able to kind of pick up and go back to work and do the lunch, and obviously school lunches are notoriously short. So it worked great for that. And it definitely was fun, and it definitely was like, aha, aha, oh, you took that spot, ooh, clever. And it had a lot of those moments, but still very light. And, you know, compared to some of the games, like, I think card play is kind of my favorite thing in two-player, and there's no cards, there's no real special abilities. So that was probably the biggest thing that was missing to me. I would have preferred some tokens with special abilities and some, like, ooh, now I could do that, or ooh, I got to hold that for just the right moment. But there was still definitely some of that, so I found it enjoyable. Didn't find it a top 10 game of the year, and I did play this in 2019, even though I'm reviewing it now in 2020, but that was that. That is Blitzkrieg, with an exclamation point. Okay, last to review, I don't think I reviewed this, and apologies if I did, but I think Mason reviewed it in an earlier episode. This is Jaws from Prospero Hall and publisher Ravensburger. And Jaws is based on the Peter Benchley novel and the movie that George Lucas made and Steven Spielberg in the 70s. And it's a two-part, two-act, essentially two-player game. It can play 4v3v1, but it's really a two-player game, I would say. It's kind of one of those ones that, yeah, can play more, but I don't think you'd want to. So what happens? First side is a hidden movement game. The shark is moving around, has some special abilities, moving from area to area in the oceans along Amity Island, and little vent cards will flip, and swimmers will jump in the ocean, and Jaws will eat them, and the other player is playing, let's see, the three humans. Oh, man. Suddenly they're jumping out of my brain, and I know them so well normally. But you've got the sheriff, and you've got Hooper, and you've got Quint, the boat captain. And you're just trying to play this little hidden movement game and launch barrels and try to hit Jaws and get two barrels attached to him so you can find out where he is. The front side is just set up for Act 2, as it should be. It's cool hidden movement, but it's, you know, a little bit random. It's a little bit just guess and see what happens. Essentially what it's trying to do is figure out who will get how many cards for the other side. So once you get two barrels on Jaws, or Jaws eats nine swimmers, you will flip over. You will then draw crew cards and shark cards based on where you were on that track, how much time it took. And so the sooner they find Jaws, the more cards the crew gets, and the later, the more cards Jaws gets. Now you flip the board over, and you've got the Orca, which is Quint's boat. And it's got eight tiles on it. And Jaws is trying to eliminate all eight boat tiles, which can be damaged and then destroyed, or destroyed outright if enough damage is done. Or Jaws is trying to eat all three of them, which they can fall in the water when those places are destroyed, and then Jaws gets to roll a die against them to damage them. I believe they all have 6 health, and then Jaws has 18 health, and the crew is trying to take out Jaws. You've got a bunch of cards. So what happens? This is where it's really interesting hidden movement. So you flip three of these cards, and they show one of the eight sections of the boat, and you lay tokens out. So Jaws is going to show up here, 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 and then Jaws will pick, I'm going to go to C, and put that face down. And then the crew will assign, they'll get to move spaces. You just, you show it, because Jaws has already picked their spot. You can move kind of spaces along the boat and then play crew cards. And you can aim. So you either aim in your space if you're going to use a melee weapon like a baseball bat or a machete, or you can use guns, which typically are limited in ammo, usually about one bullet, maybe two. And then a whole bunch of various other cards from the deck. You've got the oxygen tank, and you've got the cage, and all sorts of other things that you've seen if you've seen the movie. And so you assign these spaces you're going to attack, and then Jaws flips and says, ah, I was here, and then, oh, we're attacking here, and now anybody that aimed to that space gets to use theirs. The others get their cards back, so your weapons won't be spent until they're used. The melee weapons you get to keep forever. Most of the cards are one use. So then you do all your attacking. So the way attacking works is you roll dice that have one hit symbol, two hit symbols, and blanks on them. And you roll a certain number of dice. And, sorry, I'm driving. I thought I was going the wrong way. You roll a certain number of dice, and then you do a certain amount of damage. The shark also has, like, an avoidance. So when they pick those cards, they're picking, like, I don't know what the term is, but just a defense value. So if I roll three hits and they had a defense of two, they're only going to take one hit. So sometimes the shark is picking spots because they have high defense value. Otherwise, they're the places they're going to attack in terms of all that. There's a little bit more to it in terms of the shark can pop up in spaces that are now water if they get destroyed and then attack adjacent to that. The shark also gets attack dice after that and it can attack any people that have fallen in their space. And the shark will roll a certain number of dice that are also on those cards. So let's say it says the shark can roll three attack dice. They might only have one defense. So you're taking all those things into account. It's really clever. The thing I like is you're playing the game as much as the player. You're like, well, you could go to that space, but it makes no sense. So now I've got you 50-50 on these two spaces. And now what would that player do? Or they go to the no-sense space just to kind of cycle the cards and go to another spot. So that can happen. As the crew, you can hedge your bet. You can go to three different spaces, or you can go all in on one and just hope you get a big attack on Jaws. The game is great. It comes down to the wire. The number of cards you get in Act 1 isn't, like, game-changing. I haven't seen any games that just, like, flush their way out quickly. It's a great game with all the randomness in there. It's so fun. It's just a true reminder to me of how randomness and dice rolls and card play and hidden movement and all those secret elements are just fun. It's so much fun, and boy, did they capture Jaws. I mean, I know a lot of people are saying it now, Prospero Hall, you can't say like, oh, let's see what they do with IPs because they've done good things. They've proven they know how to handle IPs, and here we go. They put hidden movement, which is something we see in hobby games, into a mass market style game. So Jaws, two thumbs up, great game. Didn't make my top 10 games of the year, but definitely would be on my short list, which is a long short list that I will go over next episode. Brian wants to do that with me as well. I believe my next 25 games, my 11 through 35, and I'm sure by the time I actually do the episode, there'll be even more than that, that I found to be great games in 2019. So, all right, that is that for the reviews for this episode. So I'm going to move on and talk about kind of the title here, this Mercy Mission. And I just want to talk about gaming and that idea. Obviously, a lot of us game. We enjoy the hobby. We're in the hobby. We like to go play with people. It's a release. It's a way to get away. It's a way to see people. All those kind of things. And I think board gaming is great for that. Sometimes I feel like people take it upon themselves to like carry this mission of getting people to board game as though it's going to change their lives. Now, don't get me wrong. Board gaming can and does change people's lives for the better, whether it be, well, most often I would imagine people they meet, focus they have. Obviously, just getting us away from the real world is really helpful. Dealing with social emotional issues is huge. So it definitely has that element, getting us away, did I say getting away from TV and screens, those kind of things, socializing, getting us out to see people, just giving something for families to do. I mean, there's so many great things, so I don't want to take those away. But I don't know that board gaming has to be for everybody. I don't know that we better people's lives by board gaming with them. So I don't know that it's like a mission that I carry. And it certainly can be helpful. And playing with people at conventions. It was interesting, Kathy and I were talking recently about ConCon, and I wanted to go, and I wanted her to go with me, and she didn't quite understand the concept of paying to go to a convention to play games with people she didn't know. She's like, why don't I just have people come to my house, and we'll play the games here and pay nothing? And I don't think that way. I think about the idea of like, well, I'm going to pay to go to a convention. I want to play with people that I rarely see, or sometimes see, or never have played with before, and I want to teach people games where they didn't have access to a teacher, and I want to laugh with them and hear about their favorite games and have a good time, and that's an important element. But I think conventions are really for hobby gamers. I mean, you could definitely bring people and they can discover the hobby and get involved, but we're there to like play games, we're there to interact and see people, you know, friends that we don't see very often and those kind of things. I don't know that we're like spreading the idea of board gaming when we go to a convention. People have already chosen to go there and they kind of probably know about that and have a hobby game collection at their house. Now, go to the other side. Think about schools. Think about old folks' homes. Think about libraries. Think about community centers. Think about homeless shelters. I know I'm leaving things out, but think about refugee encampments. What would the correct term for that be? Or other places like this, shelters and things like that. Now, these are places where we could bring board gaming to people who are in need. Hospitals, who might not hear about it, and I think we could do some significant change. And I was reminded of this on Saturday, this past Saturday. This will come out a little later, but I was teaching at Jen, the Board Game Librarians, the Manchester Public Library, her meetup that she does once a month, and Restoration Games was there. It was great to see them and teach Unmatched. And somebody walked in and said, hey, I've heard about this event a year ago, and I spent the last 8 months gathering the courage to come here because the social anxiety that I have to walk into a building full of people and ask to play a game that I don't know that I'm capable of learning how to play, or be competitive or socialized with people while doing that, was tough for me. But I'm here now. And so I said, great, why don't we sit down and you and I will play Unmatched. We're not going to have anybody else play. We'll just get you through a game. And we played Unmatched, and they did great. They played wonderfully. They understood the game. They beat me. And it was awesome. And they said, you know, if I just play this one game, it was a victory today. And I said, you know what? It was a victory when you walked in the building. Just the fact that you walked in and you saw the surroundings and you got yourself here, that was the victory. And now playing the game are all the bonuses. Every game you get to play. And they actually stood up and went in over and played another game of Downforce with a whole group of people and whatnot. And that just reminded me how I do think there's an element I was going prior to how, you know, I wasn't so sure that it is when we just kind of go and play games with people. And I'm not sure that everybody needs to play board games. But for some people, they definitely can be. I know for me it has been. It's been a great outlet. I am a people person. I have to get out of my house, or I need to fill my house with people. That's how I keep going. When I'm down, when I'm depressed, you know, a daily depression, not a regular. I don't suffer from any of that. And thankful for that. I know many people do. But I need that extrovert. I need that, you know, extra shot of people. And so gaming at a store and teaching people and going to a convention, it's just so important for me. And games are just such a great way to do that because of the connection. But it reminded me in this situation that there are people. But it really takes work for us to do that. For us to bring board games to people and have them be something that could catalyze change in their life, it requires work. It requires sitting down with people that could be tough to play with or that do struggle with these things. It requires seeking those people out, going into uncomfortable situations. And I don't think that's for everybody. I don't think that just because you're in the hobby and people don't know about games, that's what you need to do. It's okay to just be in the hobby and use games as an outlet for yourself. Just, hey, this is the thing I'm going to do to go away and have fun. This is what I'm going to do with my family. This is what we're going to do as family trips. This is what we're going to do as a couple. We're going to go on a cruise, and it's going to be kind of fancy, and we're going to play games on the cruise. And that's fine. I think it's totally fine to be in the hobby. But if we're thinking about it in the other vein, if we really are thinking about this as a mission where we're going out, I think those are the places that we have to bring board games to the disenfranchised people, the people that just don't have the opportunity. I mean, board gaming is very much in America a middle class and up hobby, and poor people just don't have access. They can't do this cult of the new thing. That's where something like a board game library in a store or games at Jen's library or other libraries around the country and world can really reach people who couldn't afford them or get access to them otherwise, and could make a big difference. And I think that that is something that is just really important to think about. And that's something we could do and create that change. Now, still, I would argue that the change there isn't the games. It could be, as some of those things I alluded to, just helping with mental state, helping with flow, helping with thought process, helping with focus, helping with a chance to get away from the things. I think it's the people, though, that really make a difference. That's what makes this hobby so interesting and so strong. And for me, what makes me play board games versus video games. Video games I find much more toxic and much more solo. And solo isn't even bad. Inherently, there's nothing wrong with solo. But I think in general with games, it's that my mind meets your mind. And I really find it interesting when we talk about like multiplayer solitaire and saying there is an interaction. Now, certainly the game doesn't have interaction, but the players have interaction. Whether it be the conversation throughout the game, now in a heavy game where everything's silent, that doesn't happen, before, after, the post-analysis of the game, the talking about strategy of the game, just the getting together, the silence. I mean, if you think about it, two people reading a book in a room or watching a TV show in a room, there is interaction there. It's not high level, but it doesn't mean it's not interaction and it's unhealthy. I think that's an important element. And I really think when we're talking about that, we're talking about bringing games to disenfranchised people. I think it's people meeting people where they're at that's such a big deal. And so I really just go out and, again, just kind of recapping what I said, be in the hobby. Play games. Enjoy them. Don't put yourself in a situation where you need to play with somebody that would frustrate you or be difficult for you. Or, not be good for your mental state at a given time or whatever. Don't feel like you need to purposely do that. I think if gaming is your outlet, it's your mental exercise, all those things, great. But if it really does feel like something where you want to go and reach other people, like Jen's done at her library, or board game days at places, or people who run groups in schools for kids, especially special needs kids at times, or kids that just aren't involved in sports and other clubs. If that's something that interests you, then really think about that. Think about how you're interacting with people. Think about how you could bring those games to people who aren't fortunate enough to have them. Think about how you could bring those games to people. And go in, take a deep breath, recognize what's going to be difficult. This might be hard for you. It might be tough for your mental state. People might be difficult to deal with. Take a deep breath. Focus. Think about that before you do it and realize you're making a difference in somebody's life, even if that becomes difficult on you. And I would even argue if it's difficult on you, that means it's really making a difference. Because true love to me requires sacrifice. And when we're loving other people or thinking of other people, if love is too strong for you, it requires sacrifice of us, in my mind. And that's, what we can do. So is board gaming a mercy mission? No. Can it be if you set your mind that way and reach the right people? Yeah, I think it can be. I think you can really do a lot of good with this hobby. And I've seen so much positiveness. I'd be remiss if I didn't mention things like Nerd Nighters and the Jack Vassell Memorial Fund and Board Game Geek fundraisers and charities. There's so many more that I'm probably missing that are famous that also do so much good for gamers and other people in their time of need that I think are important to mention as well, which is just such a great part of the hobby. So that is that. That's all I want to say on that topic. You could agree or disagree with me for sure. hopefully we both agree that helping people is good. But you can let me know. You can email me at portalgamingpodcast@gmail.com, or you can just hit me up on Twitter at portalgaming60 with your thoughts, because this was kind of fun, hopefully enlightening, to talk about. I don't have it all figured out. I don't know that all my opinions are correct, but I like trying to enlighten people on some things in terms of all that. So there's that. And with that, I think I'll bring this episode to a close. This is episode 145. And of the Portal Gaming Podcast, I am your host, The Brant. Until next time, I hope you step into the portal.